David Novak of the Spire Project and the Information Research FAQ presents Beyond Surfing. Welcome. Many an evening I look up at the night sky and see thousands, millions, billions of stars. So vast, so beautiful, so inspiring. And as I gaze at this wondrous spectacle, something in the night sky hints to me of order and structure, of sense and design. It entreats me to look beyond the apparent chaos for something more. What do you see when you gaze at the Internet? Do you see facts, objects, pretty web pages filled with pretty pictures? Perhaps you see a web of interlinked documents, a cloud of information, an ocean. Or do you see something more, something vast, beautiful, inspiring, something that hints of order and structure, of sense and design? Quite apart from our skill at working a search engine and our experience knowing where to search, there lies a body of theory to guide our way to valuable information on the Internet. I will refer to this using the grand title of Internet Search Theory. And if you let it, it will open your eyes to a very different Internet. The vast majority of us confuse Internet searching with search engines and surfing. We fail even to notice Internet Search Theory exists. And because of this, we consider the Internet as confusing, messy, slow, and irritating. This seems a given. Anything so large and so messy has to be confusing. Oh, we typically find information we want. We often are happy with the information we find, but we shouldn't be. We should be seriously dissatisfied. Few of our searches are comprehensive or definitive. Few of our challenging questions are answered well. We should have higher expectations and higher standards. I have written a great deal on this topic over many years. I will share with you some of my thoughts. Something is missing from our understanding of the Internet, and it is not just a large collection of techniques to open the Internet up for view. We also misconceive the Internet. We consider it a web, a cloud, an ocean. This only serves to obscure much of the Internet from mind. We think in such a way that erases many of the questions we should be asking, questions that would reveal the structure, the depth, the quality to Internet information. We don't ask these questions either because we don't know how, for which there is a simple cure, or more likely because we don't know why we would want to ask such questions. A far more dangerous situation, where we search as if in a fog, without bearings and without guidance on how to proceed. In either case, we chronically underestimate the value the Internet offers us and the simplicity of the solution. This is almost amusing, since many listeners are perfectly capable of negotiating complex library environments and building vast social networks to gather and filter relevant information. Yet they bridge little of these skills to the task of searching the Internet. I shall explore with you reasons we should reach beyond search engines and surfing, peppering the discussion with various techniques that help us do so. I shall start gently with the tale of the apple and the wrench. An apple. Sweet, crisp, delicious. How else could we describe an apple? Well, if I was a chemist, I could mention how the skin of our apple is rich in antioxidants. This is why apples store so well. If I was a businessman, I could describe our apple as a product at the end of a long supply chain. If I was a marketing expert, in our apple I may see a brilliant corporate logo, perhaps for a computer company. Each angle, each discipline shows us some different aspect of our humble apple. An apple that is still sweet, crisp, and delicious, but is also so much more. An apple that is a symbol, an ingredient, a morality tale, etc. The Internet is like this apple. We can describe the Internet in many different ways. Yet for many years we have looked at the Internet from just a single perspective, only through the eyes of computer science. With these eyes, we consider the Internet as a network of computers, information scattered haphazardly across this network. To organize this information, we have vast databases that index and catalog information resources. To find information, we simply search these databases. And since there's much too much information to consider, we ask to see the more prominent, popular websites first. This is a fairly accurate description of what inexperienced use of the Internet entails. Toss words at a search engine and hope it brings us what we need. But just like our apple, there are other ways to see the Internet. Library science says a great deal about how to find information. Firstly, it considers information as already organized, self-organizing to a degree. Baskets of discreetly arranged information embedded within a vast space that contains both structure and order. Multiple overlapping classification schemes. Each item of information has a history, context, and format. Information never exists as facts divorced from reality, bereft of a history. This is library science, and such a view suggests a very different path to finding information. Such a view paints the Internet very differently to the image suggested by computer science, the image of a network of computers organized by search engines. Sociology views Internet information as communication, as a message between author and reader. This draws our attention to who is publishing and why. Messages compete for our attention, and compete not just with comparable messages, but compete also on a grander scale. Competition between mechanisms of communication, the various information ecosystems. Books compete with discussion groups, for instance. Competition also affects our motivation. Those publishing for profit rub up against those publishing for prestige and attention, as well as those publishing out of generosity, as a gift to the world. This is sociology, and such a view suggests another, different path to finding information, different again from computer science and library science. Our perspectives and our metaphors say a great deal about how we find information. See the Internet as a vast database of information, and we focus all our attention on using global search engines to find our way. Information we can't reach in this manner, questions we can't answer in this way, are lost to us. See the Internet as a web of information, leading from one page to the next, then we likely forget we can just as easily move backwards or sideways. It so happens a zigzag motion through the Internet is very effective. We move backwards by finding web pages that link to a given page that interests us. The link field search accomplishes this and is described by any search engine help page. We move zigzag by first moving backwards, then moving forwards to comparable pages mentioned alongside the link to the first page we were on. Such link companions, as they are called, are comparable resources. Such a zigzag motion is one of 5 or 6 ways to move through the Internet, search engines and directories being another, surfing, that is, moving from one page to another, following links, being a third. Should we see the Internet as a cloud of information, then we overlook all the structure, order, and organization embedded within the Internet. As a cloud, why ask how our sought-after information is organized? We quietly assume it has no organization. When we see the Internet as a discipline of computer science, then we miss that we also need library science and sociology to make sense of it. This, then, is our apple. The way we see the Internet drives the way we find information. Want better information? Fix the way we see the Internet. Now for the wrench. Does it surprise you that our largest search engine covers just 6% of the Internet? 6%. Well, the exact percentage is something to debate. It's primarily a function of what we call being on the Internet, and estimates range from 10% to fractions of a percent. The rate of growth of the Internet is not nearly as contentious. It used to double in size every 6 months. These days, it probably doubles each year. Next year, the largest search engine will index just 4% of the Internet. Think about this for a moment. In no other aspect of our life would we consider a search of 1 in 16 items acceptable. A phone book that only lists famous people. A cinema that only tells you one of the movies playing today. Perhaps a library catalog that only directs us to books starting with the letters A and B. What a ridiculous idea. Yet the Internet is certainly indexed in this manner. We cannot assume a page is indexed. We should assume a web page is not indexed unless it happens to be popular. We can assume each website has at least one page indexed, and this will hold true for probably another 2 years. This incomplete coverage has been a persistent and growing problem for the Internet. I remember with great fanfare how Google added nearly 1 billion records to its primary database on the 17th of February 2004, bringing it from 3 billion something to 4.25 billion records. However, let's keep these numbers in perspective. It crested 3 billion records in November 6, 2002, 15 months earlier. This means Google's search database grew at an annual rate of 33%. Keep in mind the internet probably doubled in size during 2003. Yes, the internet is not growing as quickly as in previous years, percentage-wise. In absolute numbers, the internet still accelerates. Just the internet may not double in size this year. But then search engines grow glacially in comparison. Furthermore, the search engine business does not require and no longer benefits greatly from rapidly growing their databases. As we will see shortly, we usually don't use search engines in ways that need great coverage. We don't often ask questions of search engines that only the largest can answer best. Let us stop for a moment and look at the grand view. Our largest search engine covers about 6% of the internet and grows perhaps a third the speed of the internet. Would it be too obvious to mention that our tools are incomplete? We shall forever search the internet with very inadequate tools. The media and public appear unaware of this. Missing 94% of anything should give us more pause, certainly little confidence. And yet to me, it's a lot like the emperor with no clothes. He's naked, but we don't mention it much. We should be asking, how do we search when our best tool, our favorite tool, covers so little of the internet? And until you can provide at least a partial answer to how you will find information not indexed by the search engines, we have not touched the true potential of the internet. We miss the point of searching well. The answer is simple. Don't imagine that the search engine is our only tool. Find other tools. Learn other techniques. If a wrench does not work, either sit there and swear at the damn wrench, or learn about something called a screwdriver. Learn about everything in our toolbox. Consider this. We sit at a computer thumbing through a vast array of web pages that are not what we want. In other words, we struggle with our trusted wrench and it's not working. Why not ask a librarian for assistance? Log into our state library website and ask a question either by email, by instant web chat, or phone for that matter. Librarians can help. This then is technique number one. Consider this. Our wrench is not working again. We thumb through many pages that are not quite right. Why not reach for one web page that almost answers our question? Then think about what that page contains that may help us find others like it. Technique number two. Of course, we use both these techniques all the time when we visit a library. We walk into a library and ask a librarian for help. We walk into a library, approach the computerized card catalog, and find a book that might interest us. We then go look at other books found on the same shelf, those above and next to our chosen book. Or instead, we look for books that share the same subject heading. In either case, we use one book to find others like it. These two simple techniques run completely alien to the computer science of focus of searching the internet as if it is a database. Yet these two techniques work splendidly on many occasions. Here's an example. I search for background information on how libraries in other countries provide online interactive assistance. I stumble. The search proves difficult. Instead of searching further in the same way, using the same tools, I log in for a short web chat with one of the librarians of the Australian Ask Now service. A librarian from Queensland assists me to correctly identify the term I need, that of virtual reference. This is the term librarians give to online interactive assistance. Instead of continuing a poor internet search on my own, I ask for help. On another occasion, I seek a couple of fine resources that show astronomical pictures of the universe. I know and love a service called Astronomy Pictures of the Day, APOD, run by NASA. There are other sites with pictures of galaxies, of course, and many are listed in the same Yahoo directory as the one that lists APOD. I merely need to request a list of web pages linking to the APOD project, again with the link field search, then visit the link from a prominent directory like Yahoo, in much the same way as a book sitting beside another on a library shelf. Other astronomy picture sites sit beside the one I love by NASA. Indeed, searching this way delivers much better results than simply approaching a search engine. Notice how I search on these occasions. I search as if I'm in a library. I ask a librarian for help. I look at web pages on the same shelf. Clearly, these are useful ways to find information. The search engine is our wrench. It is a very capable and versatile wrench, more versatile than I have yet shared with you. But the wrench is but one of many tools in our toolbox. Before you complain you can't find what you want, try some of the other tools we possess. The apple and the wrench is a simple way to explain a simple but confusing observation. The internet is not messy. It is not slow. It is not filled with poor quality information. If you are not finding what you want, it is your inexperience speaking. Don't blame the internet. It's you. For some reason, unlike almost every other task imaginable, be it driving a race car, running a marathon, or speaking before an audience, we dream the internet requires no skill or experience. We then conceive the internet in a way that ignores all the tools but one. And we think of the internet in a way that strips all theory but that of computer science. Should it really amaze us that on some occasions such an approach fails us? What lies beyond surfing? I see the difficulty and frustration most of us endure when we wander the internet, and I see that often it is born of a lack of vision, a lack of theory, a lack of knowing what to do next when we discover our answer cannot be found by surfing. It should not surprise us that surfing fails us. Surfing is such a blunt technique, a club. We throw a few words at our favorite global search engine, then we peruse the top 10 or 20 recommendations. Yes, recommendations. This is actually the perfect word, since we're not searching. Not really. Is it a search when we generate a list of 10,000 web pages, then look at the first 20? How is this different from simply looking at a list of 20 recommendations? How is this different from looking at 20 recommendations from the DMOS directory or the Yahoo directory? The difference only stems from the nature of those recommendations. If we ask the right way, search engines tend to offer more focused recommendations. Of course, recommendations often work. A simple approach is not without merit. A major directory or favorite global search engine will give fairly good answers to most simple questions. We can easily find instructions to unclog our dishwasher, retrieve the annual report for a listed company, and find the review of the latest film by Michael Moore. We can easily answer any question where the answers appear on any of 100 or 1,000 websites. When we must find just one or two sites out of so many, searching is a simple matter. Similarly, if an answer must come from a specific website, but the website is prominent, popular, and has a distinct name, again, we should have little difficulty wandering to our answer. The online registration of a business name in my state is probably not a prominent site, not a particularly popular site, but I should have little difficulty finding this particular web page, since there's so little comparable. The search is distinct. There is little chance for confusion, provided I can convey to the search engine or directory what I need. In a very similar way, time and again people ask for my web address. Why? Don't they realize that if they know my name or the project name, the Spire Project, and they know the topic, internet research or searching the internet, there will never be any difficulty in finding my website? I am the most famous David Novak who writes about searching the internet. Actually, I'm the only David Novak writing about searching the internet. There is another prominent Spire project, but it's about spectral analysis in Europe. Under most circumstances, we can easily find our way to specific sites on the internet when the information is clear, unique, and not muddied in some way. We need merely learn how to communicate our wishes to a search engine correctly. But what do we do when surfing fails us? When we ask a difficult question, a comprehensive question, a definitive question, an important question with few answers, or perhaps we ask a question where we want the best answer. Perhaps we seek a collection of information for comparison. Perhaps we seek a web page that is neither prominent nor promoted. Perhaps we seek information we can't quite articulate. In all these circumstances, recommendations are insufficient to the task. Our wrench does not work. And so, guided by advice from books, magazines, and websites on searching the internet, We walk right into an insidious trap. Yes, there is a trap, set and baited, waiting for the unwary. When we strive to gain a better understanding of the Internet, our first destination is likely to be called advanced Internet searching. Beware, for this trap is simple and seductive in its simplicity. It suggests that talent in searching is knowing whether to approach a search engine or a directory. It suggests Internet searching depends on becoming familiar with an array of global search engines, each with their own unique refinements. And this advice, on first appearance, is a collection of tools to fill our toolbox. Oh, ye insidious beast, what agony you inflict upon those so sadly entrapped. The different search engines are of minor importance in the scheme of things. Blunt searchers and directories, as I have suggested, hold much in common. They all offer us recommendations. While specific search engines may direct us more swiftly to certain simple solutions, all search engines, when used in a blunt manner, fare poorly in answering specific, definitive, and comprehensive questions. In my experience, most of the best searchers seldom use more than two global search engines habitually. Instead, they deepen their understanding of just one or two global search engines, then study the limitations of all search engines in a rather pessimistic manner. Few enthuse over each new search engine or search advance that attracts media attention. They do not fill their toolbox with an abundance of search tools that essentially fill the same role. Instead, talented searchers move more carefully, differently, because they want something recommendations in surfing can't offer. The apple and the wrench and the insidious trap is one way to explain the Internet blues. These blues descend on any thinking person who persists in using the Internet long enough for their wild enthusiasm to wear off. Then we replace enthusiasm with a dissatisfying frustration that many of our more important questions are so dreadfully difficult to answer with the Internet. Don't get me wrong, I love the Internet. I have, after all, dedicated much of my life to understanding it. But the Internet is not what we wish it to be. It has its own nature, its own preferences. The technology behind the Internet helps us accomplish certain tasks. But nothing in the technology promises some of the improvements we ask of it. In psychological terms, we transfer a great many wishes and hopes to this Internet technology without really stopping to think if the ability to find an obscure scientist working in isolation halfway around the world was ever really promised by the Internet. Sorry. But this and many other tasks were never promised. The trouble is, once we realize searching can seriously challenge us, and it seems to be getting more challenging, not less, then we become deeply disappointed. The Internet blues descend upon us. Many of us slowly work our way out from these difficulties, learning more about the Internet in the process, until we are happy at the strengths of the Internet and have a more realistic expectation for the Internet. That is, if we don't drop our expectations to meet our skills. I find we can position people along this path, stretching from enthusiastic but unskilled, through disappointed and unskilled, and then on to more skilled and less disappointed. Well, let us look further ahead. Let us cure these Internet blues with a little foreknowledge. For there are serious ramifications for not finding information. Firstly, we miss productivity. We spend too long searching the Internet, and we spend much too much time looking in the wrong direction. This is not good use of our time and energy. We are inefficient. Secondly, we risk being ill-informed or uninformed. We rely on inferior information when better information sits nearby. This can have tremendous costs when poor information leads us to make a bad decision. We may fairly claim as a cost of being ill-informed not only any costs associated with correcting a mistake, but also some of the lost opportunity costs. Being ill-informed can cost plenty. Thirdly, alas, we sacrifice our enjoyment. We feel frustration instead of elation. Where is the thrill of the chase, the quickening of our heart as we entrap our answer? Instead, we stumble and hit our head on some fact we seek. Whoopee. Lastly, we have a social cost. The information revolution is supposed to set us free, not entwine us in an arduous task of searching in vain. Not dangle the promise of perfect understanding, then provide only partial, good enough information. Without success in connecting to great information, the Internet revolution withholds many of its further gifts from the world. Here we have four reasons to pursue some decent internet skills: enhance productivity, inform decisions, enjoyment, and for the good of the information revolution. Four obvious reasons, perhaps a little trite and boring. Saying these reasons in this way almost completely strips them of importance. It fails, for instance, to capture the essence of being a connoisseur of information, demanding and receiving high-quality specific information. It fails to draw out the connection between being informed and the process of innovation. It fails to demonstrate just what improvements to productivity and mood we should aspire to. So let's look again at why we should develop some decent internet skills. We start with productivity. The internet changes the way we work, but we do have alternative ways to gather information. Want to know the movies Catherine Zeta-Jones appears in? Visit a good video store and ask to view their directory of movies, a real fat binder from memory. Want to hunt for new books on microbanking in the developing world? Visit a good bookstore and ask to search their Books in Print database. They probably subscribe to the CD version. Want to know what to feed your daughter's pet hermit crab? Visit a public library. We can, alternatively, answer these questions with the internet in a delightfully fast, convenient, and cost-effective manner. Catherine Zeta-Jones acts in 27 movies, according to the Internet Movie Database. Hermit crabs eat pretty much anything in various states of decay, but they need variety, according to a pet site I encountered. As for books, well, the internet does not provide a workable business model to bring books in print to the internet, except as an annual commercial subscription. The best free search we can do is a search of Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, the government book databases, and a few other resources. I wrote a good article for the Spire Project on this topic years ago. These are simple examples. Simple examples that demonstrate a simple efficiency. No more 20-minute trip to the bookstore to check if a new book has come. Simply visit a few sites when you check your email. When our questions become difficult, do we still have opportunities for efficiency? Yes, clearly. When we seek the latest research into detection of hemochromatosis, a surprisingly common genetic disorder, an experienced internet searcher will find and participate in a very informed and active mailing list of fellow survivors, and will also monitor Medline, an important free medical database. An inexperienced searcher will what? Probably forget to look for discussion groups, will hunt through numerous encyclopedia-like descriptions of the disease, then, after becoming frustrated, proclaim the answer is not on the internet, when it is. Next, seek the assistance of a commercial researcher to undertake an expensive search of commercial medical databases to compile a bibliography. Next, visit a university library to view some articles. And lastly, purchase some additional articles with the assistance of an expensive commercial article service. The skilled internet searcher will find brilliant information, superior to the commercial article search in this case. The inexperienced searcher will probably seek the help of an experienced internet searcher, for the alternative is tedious, time-consuming, and dreadfully expensive. So internet skills, just like internet access, offers us a significant productivity advantage. We usually frame these skills in terms of value. Skilled searchers find more valuable information. But this is just as clearly about productivity. An unskilled searcher may need to retreat to non-internet resources and all the time, tedium, and dreadful expense that entails. The skilled searcher can stay on the internet and provide more immediate answers while sipping peppermint tea with classical music playing in the background. On some occasions, our haste in moving through the internet really matters. An unskilled searcher finds a resource in 10 minutes while a skilled searcher takes 5. This is actually unusual. Oh, there are several skills and techniques to improve our speed in searching. For instance, the web address gives clues as to the contents of a web page. And a skilled internet user will interpret the web address, will consider if it's likely to have the answers wished for. This kind of anticipation is much faster than simply moving progressively through a list of recommendations. Just pick and choose the most likely and respectable resources thrown up by the search engine. A second skill involves jumping between separate windows, thereby breaking the one window to the internet dilemma and the World Wide Web wait. A skilled internet user will have several windows open, and by using shortcut keys, will bounce among the several windows, never having to wait for information to download. Most long-term internet users naturally began interpreting web addresses and juggling windows on their own. These skills can be developed further towards anticipating resources and nonlinear research styles. There is much to learn that makes the search process faster, but most of these skills resemble touch typing, worth learning only if you can justify the time. But I mentioned how speed tends not to be an issue because usually in a race, an inexperienced searcher fails to find comparable information. The internet is blessed with a simple split. Either anyone can quickly find answers simply by surfing, or only experienced searchers will find useful answers. Unskilled users will fail to reach or fail to recognize something of value. This is one reason why we usually overlook the productivity of internet skills. We don't think to ask the questions we can't ask without skill. Say we receive an email from arthur@gdc.com and wish to know more about who sent it. We only have the email address. Such a search is simplicity itself, a minute search at best. Once we know how to trace an email address to an organization, to a person, then on to background information. Unfortunately, if we don't know how to proceed, we would probably not think to look for background information. A second reason why we overlook productivity is because we move into areas of marginal benefit. We check the movies playing in our local cinema when honestly, a phone call to the cinema is just as simple. We set about retrieving a quotation by Shakespeare, then judge that even an inexperienced searcher could surf to the answer. Why spend time learning internet skills? Truly, any basic internet user can quote Shakespeare. They need only find one or two sites from among hundreds that can help. Such a task does not demand skill. I dare say, with all my years of experience studying the internet, I am only marginally faster at retrieving a simple passage from, say, a book by Jane Austen. We would both probably just toss the words Jane Austen into a search engine. I would punctuate my search request, and I will select which site I visit with care, but I would still start by surfing. By punctuate, I mean I would put Jane Austen in quotations to keep the words together. I may also subtract a word or request a title or link search. This is all accomplished with punctuation. But with Jane Austen, I would still start with a search engine and a little surfing because these are the best techniques for this occasion. But if I encounter difficulties finding the words of Jane Austen, or I craft a more challenging search, then surfing quickly spirals into repetition. As surfing fails, I shall call upon a range of alternative approaches to reach my answer. Another way we may discount the productivity and efficiency of internet skills is by envisioning the internet rather naively as offering free access to everything. We then lament when we can't search the books and print database freely. And we see the internet as inefficient because our state library surely invites us to browse the print version free of charge. Sorry, but some of the gifts have not yet arrived. In years to come, our society will make better use of commercial information on the internet, either through micropayments of 10 cents per page, perhaps, through grant funding. My local public library already provides me with internet access to the expensive Compass directory, or some other solution. It just hasn't happened yet. A fourth and final reason we discount productivity is simply how we experience the internet. We think about time we spend, not about time we save. Yet efficiency applies whether the research project takes half an hour or 5 hours. You may be horrified at the thought of 5 hours in front of a computer, even with a cappuccino and jazz music. It just mortifies some people. And perhaps it should. Maybe I'm unusual in how I can stare at a computer for hours without falling asleep. But then, long searches are often the most productive. They save the most money, the most effort. The extra time allows us to more fully understand how the information we seek is organized, and by whom. Often the answers reach the highest quality and lead to comprehensive answers, two achievements decidedly difficult to attain without skill. But still the shock and horror of working 5 hours to find answers of great value. Few organizations would welcome such lengthy searching, and many circumstances may prevent such searching. Many of the librarians I teach expect to spend no more than 5 minutes helping any particular patron. What then? Well, two answers. Firstly, if 5 hours shocks you, then you have not been to the state library recently. Remember, the internet is so wonderful because skilled use of the internet is so efficient. The non-internet alternatives are expensive and take longer. If you have only 10 minutes, then it simply means you can get about 10 minutes worth of an answer. That, or we get no answer and get halfway to the library. The second answer to limited time is to focus intently on making the best use of our 10 minutes. Tackle smaller, simpler questions and make the most use of our skills at moving through the internet quickly. As an aside, enhanced productivity also applies to those delivering information. No librarian walks us to the bookshelves to show us books about taking care of pets. No books were purchased in the making of this audio CD. I met a guy and I searched the net. As a more serious example, the Medline database maintained by the U.S. National Library of Medicine exploded from 7 million searches in 1996-97 to 250 million searches in the year 2000. A 2004 report places traffic at more than 45 million a month, so over 530 million searches a year. And in this success, millions of world citizens become more informed of their health. All it took was to shift Medline from being a commercial database to a free internet database. Producers of information can enjoy tremendous efficiencies, as any successful webmaster can attest. That many web projects fail is less a result of internet inefficiency and more a result of trying to do something too close to the edge of being viable. Most first-time authors write books that are barely commercially viable. It should not astound us that many websites fail to attract ample attention. Such efforts would never succeed beyond the web. Let us now turn to a second reason to acquire skill in searching the internet: being informed. The internet is a fascinating beast that offers to connect us directly to the information we need, a world of information at our fingertips. Sadly, it's where we translate our needs into questions that we often go wrong. We are usually woefully inept at asking useful questions. Allow me to explain. I approach a global search engine and type in a few words: new internet search engines. I add no punctuation, I just type these four words and press search. What is my question? Well, I ask for a list of web pages that mention new internet search engines. Technically, I only ask for web material that includes all four of my words. This is why one of the first recommendations describes not a new search engine, but a New Zealand search engine. In general, however, references will include the most popular pages with my words appearing together. Armed with a few recommendations, I dutifully rush off to tour the internet. Most likely, I overlook the rest of the answer provided by the search engine, the number of matches, and the organizations offering answers. How enlightening is this search? Well, that depends on what I need. If all I want is the names for a few new search engines, well, then I may succeed. Actually, just having a look, it looks like I won't. But if what I really want is a list of new search engines that have successfully launched from near obscurity in the last 2 years, well, I really missed the mark. My need bears little relation to the question I ask. And so I stay uninformed. Not because the internet is unhelpful, but because I ask a dumb question. Well, maybe not dumb, but certainly a question that will not take me anywhere near where I want to go. It is truly surprising how frequently we are kept from the information we want simply because we phrase our question in an unhelpful manner. Librarians are well skilled in handling this situation. Any reference librarian in the world, when approached by a patron, starts by discussing what they hope to find. Together with the patron, they create a few good questions, a few revealing questions. To craft revealing questions, play the detective. Entrap information by skillfully asking the right questions, then listen carefully to the nuances associated with the answers. Type something into a search engine. Do we look at the number of matches? Do we notice the types of organizations recommended by the search engine? Are these answers coming from sources we want to hear from? These nuances help us ask revealing questions. There is another obstacle besides poor questioning. We also have to consider the value of the information we finally come to rely on. Quality matters. And the solution is not just ensuring we only consume high-quality information, but equally synthesizing excellent conclusions from various flawed pieces of information. Poor information from diverse and transparent sources combine in a process called synthesis, a process I shall discuss more fully in my next audio CD. But put simply, we cannot eat only at the finest restaurants if we want to sample all the food the world has to offer. Sometimes we simply only have biased information to work with. Beyond quality of information, we also have the quality of our search. Being informed is more than just asking the right questions, more than building a quality answer. It is also a state of mind, a conclusion and confidence in our conclusion, confidence in our search. We believe our conclusion, and further, we believe we search in such a way that we did not miss critical information that would change our mind. Somehow, 20 references from a list of 10 million containing the words new internet search engines simply fails to bring us any closer to deciding if we should be involved in launching a new search engine. We are not informed, and we will not become informed. We will never become informed in this manner, for we ask a poor question for the task, and any answer will not be comprehensive. Skilled questioning and being an information connoisseur are two aspects of being informed. There is one further aspect, our attitude. To what degree are we interested in and aware of the work of our peers and colleagues? Do we want to be informed? This attitude is critical to the task of innovation. It lies at the core of our relationship with our peers, in how we allow the ideas of others to inform and assist us in all knowledge work. Say we're about to craft a policy statement for internet use in our organization, or decide on a way to motivate our employees, or interpret the science revealed by a new Hubble photograph, or any of a thousand tasks that actually require the creative use of our brain. What do we do? Well, we have three options. One, we can create the solution ourselves in isolation. Two, we can gather input from someone with relevant experience. And three, some combination of the two. We are describing the interplay between invention and synthesis. The key here is that synthesis, merging information from diverse experience into a solution, is often superior to invention. Why would we craft new childcare reform legislation in isolation, when some 50 or more states and countries in the world have recently crafted comparable legislation, and many would have valuable input to offer? Quite frankly, it's a big world out there, and with a great deal of experience. It's rather naive and arrogant to think others don't have useful advice for us. Indeed, recognizing this, we listen and ask and build relationships with peers and colleagues. We participate in associations, hold town hall meetings, and we hire consultants all to gather some of this elusive experience we appreciate and value. Once informed, then we make a decision. A superior decision better than anything we could invent working alone. The internet has a part to play in this process. If we have the skills to draw upon precise and relevant information, the internet becomes a meaningful and, very importantly, an active way to gather the input and experience of others. Active because we search for what we need. Association membership, colleague relationships, and keeping up to date with current trends and trade magazines are all passive ways to gather information. We hope to make use of the experience later. With active searching, we seek information relevant to today's problem now. We are circling a central question of professionalism. Do we listen to the work of others? Do we invite input and seek inspiration from other people who have looked at very similar situations and found solutions? Do we participate in the world of information that has grown up around us? Being informed is wonderful. And it is more than a state of mind, it is also an attitude, a belief that others hold views we want to know, married to the ability to reach for those views, and the skills to appreciate the quality and comprehensiveness of our results. Beyond surfing also lies something more personally rewarding, fun. Fine searching bears a likeness to fine musical ability, in that both display talent in motion. I swoop, I plunder, I skip over unlikely venues selecting interesting information while noticing sites ripe with fruit. I observe an interesting page, then immediately dig out all the pages nearby, a request I know seldom occurs to inexperienced searchers. Nearby web pages share most of the same web address. When we ask a large global search engine for all the pages that share the same website and directory tree, and we do this with the URL field search, then we generate a list of further pages found in the same directory. And presumably all these pages share the same topic and the same author. I notice a page of uncertain date, so I fetch a copy of what the page looked like 18 months ago. Again, a request I know seldom occurs to inexperienced searchers. This is accomplished by opening a new window on your web browser, then directing it to the Internet Archive at archive.org and looking at their collection of old copies of popular websites. Time and time again, I ask questions that illuminate information that interests me. Then I explore. And I explore a region of knowledge in the same way a cave crawler explores a cavern. Out comes my light, and I shine it at some splendid, hidden-away vision. I look for a way forward, and then I step into another chamber and reveal a new dazzling sight. It's such a buzz. Such enjoyment, however, is not automatic. We must search fast, ferocious, nimble, and with pride. Fast? Well, we must move quicker than the snail's pace that searching usually unfolds. This means juggling windows, nonlinear research, a computer running software optimized for searching, use of several shortcut keys, and a collection of search tools close at hand to speed our way. If we search slowly, with time enough to watch the honey slowly drip onto our toast in the morning, waiting endlessly for pages to download, please don't hope to enjoy searching. It's too painful to watch. Speed is one of the keys. I mention ferocious because internet searching is a contact sport. We smash into the information world, club our way in, then pummel it into submission. If we are dainty and delicate and gentle, we've the wrong attitude. Who writes this article? What is their experience? Do you think that organization would publish what we need? Get me an alternative view. I don't trust you yet. Where are the peer-reviewed articles? Why have we not heard from a government source yet? Ask these questions, brutally, with passion. Demand answers. The internet will try to dissuade you, to turn your questions towards lukewarm and bland information. It will drive you continually towards okay information, good enough information, anonymous, general, incomplete information. The best information only comes with perseverance and attitude. We also search with pride, celebrate success, agonize over frustrations. Get intimate when searching. Today's search saves real time and effort. If it didn't, perhaps it was a bad search. If it does save time and money, excellent. We draw to us guidance we did not need to forge ourselves. Furthermore, when our search makes us informed, and being informed we make an excellent decision, then by all rights, our search is partly responsible for the excellent decision and all that arose from that decision. I search for a bed and breakfast in southern France. I want inexpensive yet enchanting surroundings. And I succeed. Not content with one or five or a list offered by some broker of overseas bed and breakfast, I find more definitive lists in French. Or rather French translated by a free translation service. Oh yes, I save money. I also find a perfect location to spend a few weeks alone with my wife. I celebrate not just the couple hundred euro I save by searching effectively, I also celebrate the joy I will have vacationing in a more perfect setting. On another occasion, I search for the topic employee loyalty, because a colleague is writing a document that reads well but needs two additions. Firstly, some anonymous quotes should be attributed. Secondly, he needs more of an international perspective. And I succeed. I attribute most of the anonymous quotes using a database by Amazon.com and searching a global search engine in a specific way. I also hunt for UN or US government reports on employee loyalty. Notice how specific I am. Notice how aggressive I am. For I will demand something specific or a reason why it's not there. I find Singaporean case study on retention of valued employees in knowledge-intensive companies. I find hiring and keeping police officers, a study for the U.S. Department of Justice. This and several other documents answer the need perfectly. They represent not just an international view, but also new ideas perhaps suitable for Australia. So I celebrate. Did I help a colleague appear more professional and earn more business? Did I help import some successful ideas into Australia? I certainly did more than fill a small hole in a small report and earn a favor from a friend. Recognize value. Take pride in our talent. The information revolution delivers a dramatic fall in the cost of searching, but this does not mean that information has little value. It has tremendous value in the right hands. And when we find this tremendous value, celebrate and enjoy. I ask you to consider, lastly, that beyond surfing lies the information revolution. Vive la révolution. The internet revolution, a significant part of the larger information revolution, has accomplished wonders and promises to change our society further in wonderful, even glorious ways. But these changes depend, in part, on us finding better information and truly being informed. Let us consider an example. The internet has radically improved the idea of government transparency. The Freedom of Information Act certainly helps. It clears away the darkness under which all sorts of backhand deals and corruption is possible. As the slogan goes, sunlight kills germs. Nothing sanitizes public life like attention. Freedom of information threatens visibility. The internet offers one better, actual visibility. Proactive government agencies publish significant reports and important decisions for public attention. Hiding is not an option, for publishing is the process. And in this process, we the public can watch our government working on our behalf. We usually don't. We usually don't care. But it's published. There is little option of hiding or disguising decisions, and any mistake is glaringly obvious. Let us consider another example. The internet is likely our grandest form of assistance to the developing world. In a decade or two, we will look back at this time and say the internet was the most significant tool for bridging the knowledge gap in our world. It transfers tremendous quantities of information of inestimable value from the developed to the developing world. From Adelaide, Sagric International sends employees to developing countries like New Guinea and East Timor to undertake development projects paid for by Western grants. A librarian at Sagric, that I had the pleasure to teach, oversees the information needs of these Sagric employees, often working in remote and rural communities. Such communities often have negligible access to simple medical advice, development experience, and markets. Any conduit becomes very valuable, and the internet is that conduit, even the internet in the hands of an aid worker and a distant librarian. But such work depends in part on us finding the information we need. If we stay solely to that portion of the internet we surf to, then we miss the opportunity to answer more challenging questions. And that means we miss or delay the benefits the internet offers us, be it in government transparency, the international movement of information, market transformation, the rapid dissemination of current medical research, the liberation of information from closed libraries and associations, as well as gifts yet to come, like a market mechanism for commercial information, the dissolution of media bias, and greater opportunities for cross-cultural exchange. So, what lies beyond surfing? I have argued greater productivity, being informed, enjoyment, and the furthering of a revolution. But wait, we have another way to answer this question. Beyond surfing lies a great deal of very good information. Let us just look at the information for a moment. What do we miss when we scan search engines and when we surf? If we're not careful, we may believe the internet holds little information of interest to us that we would not stumble upon quickly and easily. And truthfully, we should seriously consider staying with surfing if we are in primary school. Most of the questions we ask as children are abundantly answerable from a small collection of encyclopedic websites and the recommendations of a few search engines. At this level of education, we need only practice in asking questions and perhaps some guidance in recognizing resources suitable for school-age audiences. But I have grown, and as an adult, I yearn for more detail. I put more effort into my searches, and I search for something more useful. My young daughter takes a liking to a little deep-sea spider in a jar at a museum. Ugly little thing, but she likes it. I want to show her a collection of pretty pictures of these spiders as they live in the ocean. I don't want 5 pictures. I don't want 10. I want a gallery of spider pictures, in color, showing their cute side, not the frightening pictures, thank you. I want accompanying pretty stories and descriptions I can use to put my daughter to sleep. And time again, I allow my wishes to guide my searches. I aim for spectacular and bypass what I would put up with. And this approach has real value. I was invited to search beside another researcher at a government agency in New Zealand almost 5 years ago. We were hunting for information about what to do with the invading seaweed, foreign to the ecosystem, and being removed from the New Zealand coastline. Side by side, we searched. Side by side, we compared notes. My companion found much information about what seaweed consists of, found who uses it. The cosmetic industry buys seaweed. I found an expert who had recently worked with another New Zealand government agency to establish a seaweed farm in a nearby South Pacific island. My search results were much more valuable. In this way, I am a connoisseur of information. And as a connoisseur, I have high expectations. I demand more of the information I consume. Are you a connoisseur? Near the start of my career as an information pioneer, I embarked on one of the most revealing studies of the nature of the Internet. I reviewed and cataloged all the resources that provide country profiles. On the Internet, in libraries, and in commercial resources, I described and compared each resource, and then wrote a 7-page article about the experience that still sits on my website. The study says a great deal about the Internet. It tells us about what we have and what we miss when we search. On the Internet, I found free country profiles from more than 40 of the most highly respected organizations in the world. I found general country profiles from the CIA, from the Country Indicators of Foreign Policy, from the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, as well as the U.S. Library of Congress, the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Census Department, the U.S. InfoNation, the U.N. Statistical Division, UNICEF, and the World Bank, and several others. I found travel advisories from Australia, Canada, the U.K., and the U.S. I found country health reports from Health Canada, the Pan American Health Organization, the U.S. CDC, and the World Health Organization. I found country reports on war and justice from Amnesty International, the Canadian Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, Canadian Forces College, CARE, ELDIS, Human Rights Watch, the Red Cross, the Initiative for Conflict Resolution and Ethnicity, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the U.S. Committee for Refugees, the U.S. Department of State, and the UNDP. I also found economic country profiles from Australia, the EU, the FAO, the IMF, the New Zealand Trade Board, the OECD, the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Embassies, the U.S. Trade Representative, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the UN Industrial Development Organization. This is truly an impressive list. Many of the most significant organizations in the world are included. Now compare this list with tossing the words country profile at a search engine. We find perhaps 5 or 7 of the country profiles just mentioned. The others are simply buried too deep in the Internet to find by surfing or simple searching. Many important country profiles are not popular, promoted, or otherwise likely to rise to the top of a search engine results page. Instead, surfing and search engines excavate a great many resources that serve as proxies for a good encyclopedia. Many will be .com sites, lacking both the depth and authority all great information possesses. Surfing would surely miss the huge published tomes of the OECD, each running to over 80 pages of quality economic forecasting. Instead, we reach out to news organization summaries that appear to miss economic commentary entirely. Great resources fill the Internet, but we don't stumble upon more than a few. Let us contrast the search for country profiles with another search. I am interested in a suitable hotel to stay in Brisbane, and I don't want a list of recommended hotels. I want a list of all hotels in Brisbane. I want discounted rates, not at one hotel, but at many Brisbane hotels. I want maps. And with this information, I will save a couple $100s, I will walk to where I deliver my seminar, and I will cross the road to take my daughter for a swim. So I search. First, simply by tossing a few words to a search engine, Brisbane hotels, and I am quickly successful. Eighth down the list is whatif.com, my favorite discount hotel service for last-minute hotel reservations, complete with maps. No further searching required. What? All I needed is to surf? Well, yes. In this case, we have an ally, a company that maintains a list of discounted hotel rooms in Australia and several other countries. They did the work for us, and they are sufficiently easy to find that we don't need stellar search skills to dig them out. Surfing suffices. Information can be organized or can be disorganized. It may simply be a matter of typing a couple words or may require great skill to uncover. What is hidden and what is clearly visible is a story I can tell you another time. But what is relevant now is how the Internet is organized or disorganized. Country profiles are scattered through the Internet, but discounted hotel rooms are grouped tightly together. Organized and disorganized. Strange, then, that we would consider the Internet as a cloud or an ocean. Wasn't that one of the popular views of the Internet I mentioned earlier? I know a few clouds made up of partly organized droplets. I always thought of clouds as more uniformly messy. Let's look at another example as well. When I travel abroad, I seek venues from which to deliver my seminars. I like auditoriums. I like lecture theaters. I don't prefer hotels. Finding a suitable auditorium in a distant city is not an easy task. For starters, just typing Auditorium Denver and pressing search will only reveal the largest auditoriums in the city of Denver, those with private websites, marketing staff, and marketing budgets. Many of the places I choose won't have websites and may not even be promoted. A museum has a lecture theater. A public library has a room for hire. A community hall sits empty. And then, of course, the hotel rooms and the grand convention centers have rooms as well. To find the less promoted venues, two great leaps of inspiration are required. Firstly, the term we are looking for is not auditorium. The term is meeting rooms. This is the term the event management industry uses. Auditoriums are just the large sites with hundreds and thousands of seats. Auditoriums and convention centers are organized by companies not too dissimilar to whatif.com in their list of last-minute hotel rooms. Got 1,000 attendees? No sweat. These businesses will help event organizers connect with suitable venues. But such businesses don't take an interest in smaller rooms, the library rooms, the halls, the museum lecture theaters. I wonder, are there directories of meeting rooms? Well, museum directories are easy enough to find. We could certainly search each nearby museum for their meeting room or lecture theater. Another solution is to look for meeting rooms used by peers. Other speakers travel the world and speak at venues that are not hotels. A list of a speaker's seminar sites would provide us with a list of possible venues. Such lists are supremely patchy, but are certainly available. For a serious and comprehensive list of meeting rooms, we have two solutions. Firstly, in the U.S., the government agency responsible for pursuing handicap access in meeting rooms sometimes records a list of all meeting rooms in their state. Sometimes they publish this list to the Internet. We can clearly identify such lists since they sit on government websites. The real definitive directories, however, reside on the websites of each Convention and Visitors Bureau. Almost all maintain a list of nearby meeting rooms, large and small, within their community. These lists are found on their websites, but only rarely will these lists be indexed by the search engines. In Australia, each local government authority keeps such a directory, and for a phone call, we'll email it to you, often as not. Wow! Everything and more we ever wanted to know about finding obscure meeting rooms in far distant corners of the globe. Surely, we can now find a more suitable meeting room in Winnipeg, Canada. We will not stumble upon a venue, as surfing suggests. Instead, we will search where logic and experience tells us meeting rooms will be found. Our search will be comprehensive, and as we search, we will not feel lost. One aspect of searching the Internet is finding the most accurate phrase to search with. We use meeting rooms, not auditorium. As I search for employee loyalty, I also notice useful information using the terms employee retention and staff loyalty. Employee motivation and staff commitment also appear. In the medical field, the preferred term is personnel loyalty. This term I found using MeSH, the medical thesaurus used by Medline. The search for keywords is not always obvious. Yet for some searches, finding the right keywords is the critical step to reaching information. I would never have found the guidelines for librarians providing Internet search advice without the term virtual reference. There are several effective techniques for finding the required terms. One technique, I think, could be the use of an industry-specific thesaurus. Use MeSH for medical terms. Use the ERIC thesaurus for educational terms. I wonder if employee loyalty, staff loyalty, and employee retention would all be interrelated by a proper business thesaurus. An obvious connection? An obvious search technique? I wonder. Certainly the thesaurus features prominently in commercial research and commercial databases. But the Internet, I suspect not yet. Certainly little is mentioned of this idea. In all honesty, the thesaurus is a minor technique of limited value. Easy to understand, easy to describe, but not nearly as revealing as some of the more pivotal techniques like link companions and context-based quality assessment. Pivotal techniques I'll explain another day. But the thesaurus does explain how the field of Internet search theory is developing. Piece by piece, it comes to us from various disciplines, borrowed and translated across to work on the Internet. There are many techniques. I have a list of about 30 on my website, and another 20 I describe in my seminars. I'm sure there are more, though I try hard to collect them. They are held in the minds of researchers the world over, but are poorly catalogued and poorly communicated. If we add to these techniques a knowledge of some of the more significant resources, some of the large hidden web databases, for instance, then we have a clear picture of Internet searching and a clear improvement on surfing. If the basic approach is to toss words at a search engine, then surf. Above this, we have our list of 50-odd techniques and a degree of experience in understanding the Internet. And so, like a dancer, we learn a collection of maneuvers, simple techniques that bring certain information into focus. We learn how to retrieve a list of people who endorse a website. We learn how to skate across link companions. We learn how to draw upon a thesaurus to find key terms we need. And once we are skilled at executing such search techniques, well, then we have mastered the retrieval of information from the Internet. We have reached the pinnacle of search expertise. Oops. We've missed something. The essence of a fine dance performance is not only the skill of the dancer. It is also in the choreography. Beyond surfing lies something more than the ability to execute some 50 maneuvers. Exquisite dance requires both skill and choreography. We cannot achieve an excellent search without these techniques in our repertoire. But there is more to searching. To use another metaphor, consider the surgeon, skilled at carving the Sunday turkey roast and getting much too intimate with our intestines. Skill is clearly not everything. Without the right diagnosis, a surgeon will still make a serious mess. And so, as we wander the Internet, familiar with a range of search tools, supported by the ability to execute a range of search techniques, we must lastly display some notion of choreography to guide us to where we think most appropriate to look. For if we do not choose wisely, well, we may not find our answers. How are we to know where to look? In this regard, I consider the most important clues to emerge from the web address, the elevated vista, the process of anticipating information, and our concept of the Internet. I tend to group all this under a banner of theory. When I teach the tools, techniques, and concepts of Internet searching. Alas, all the searching in the world will not draw us to the particular site with the best listing of bed and breakfasts in southern France if we do not have the mental inspiration to ditch the English language tools and speed our way to French resources. And we would if we knew the theory of regional Internet space. The expectation that topics of regional interest will eventually cede to regional resources and to a regional approach. The two primary regional resources are regional search engines, Search Engine Colossus is the definitive directory, and regional English language newspapers, of which there are several significant directories. Now, should you seek a list of local events scheduled in Melbourne or in Rome, and local events are also best organized regionally, then it becomes logical, perhaps even obvious, to consider reaching for a regional resource. Our diagnosis is clear. And it is clear not because we know how to search regional Internet space, nor because we have experience searching in this topic. Clarity comes because we understand the Internet from theory. The foundations of Internet search theory rest in understanding how information is published, indexed by search engines, and sought by the majority of Internet users. There is further theory for judging quality, anticipating information, and understanding why information is published in the first place. There is much to learn. Let me start to conclude this audio CD. Beyond surfing resides more tools, about 50 search techniques, and a body of Internet search theory. Beyond surfing, we find better information. We have a more productive, efficient experience, and the chance to be truly informed. Beyond surfing lies the connoisseur of information, a chance to have fun and further a revolution. Earlier I asked, how do we seek information not indexed by a global search engine? Can you now see the method? We fill our toolbox with alternative tools. And so we ask for help, find comparable information first, drive towards the website of organizations we suspect would answer our question, or perhaps we simply search for the page next to or above our destination. But we have options. The global search engines do not stand alone. We predict and excavate such answers following the ideas of Internet search theory. There is more to learn about the Internet. I have yet to delve into quality. The sociological approach to Internet information is most illuminating. Then there are the 50 or so techniques to learn. And of course, we should all certainly know how to ask very specific questions of the search engines. How to punctuate and request field searches, like the link and URL field searches. There are further advances. I only pretend to be omniscient. Every few months, new ideas occur, not just to me, but to many Internet pioneers. The future unrolls before us. Oh, a fair amount of this future is predictable. We know the Internet will grow further. We know surfing and searching will falter. We also know many of the skills required to answer more difficult questions. Let us now return to the beginning. Let us reconsider our apple. How we imagine the Internet says a great deal about how we find information. What were the metaphors I used? A web, a cloud, an ocean. In the early days of the Internet, the popular metaphor was that of a library, with all the books dumped on the floor and the lights turned off. May I offer a more revealing alternative? Instead of a web, the Internet is a mesh, a woven fabric of links and neighbors and endorsements and other relationships and connections. Instead of computer science, Internet search theory consists of elements of computer science, library science, and sociology. Instead of a cloud of information, the Internet is like the stars in the inky blue-black night. Apparent chaos, but look more closely and see a great deal of hidden structure, order, and organization. This is not always a simple realm to negotiate. We are surrounded by too much information. Our tools are not what we wish them to be. Yet we can find our way. The Internet can be forced to reveal its secrets. In the words of William Shakespeare, "'Tis true, there's magic in the web. A Sibyl, in her prophetic rage, sowed the work." This is David Novak. I hope you've enjoyed Beyond Surfing. This audio CD is copyright November 2004 by David Novak, all rights reserved. Additional publications, seminars, and rights requests via spireproject.com.
Additional. David Novak here. As of 2013, I now place this CD under a Creative Commons Attrib Non-Com No Deriv license.